This episode of The Bladder Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. It is a trying time for most of us, financially, in other ways as well. And for this podcast in particular, ad revenue has slowed down significantly for the foreseeable. But for just $5 a month, the Best Evidence newsletter brings you reviews, updates on cases, author interviews, discussion threads, and even the occasional bingo card every weekday. If you have the means right now, a subscription to Best Evidence is the best way to support the podcast. Your paid subscription helps me and Eve bring you great content, pay our contributors, and keep the lights on, literally. You can sign up or give the newsletter as a guaranteed zero viral load gift at bestevidence.fyi. And if you don't have the means right now, we get it. Hang in there, and I hope The Bladder Presents provides a temporary distraction from capital A, all of this. And it's going to start trying to do that right now.
There's a bunch of small things that added up to be pretty fucking significant. I went too fast, and it fucked us all.
Gee, I really wish a documentary existed that hung a lantern on Buncee's repeated fulminating about the NCAA paying its athletes, said nobody, ever. But here it is anyway, as HBO's The Scheme illuminates the strange true story of Christian Dawkins, the hypocrisies of amateurism, and why director Pat Condellis may be the most underrated guy working in sports docs. Later, we're looking at Finding Steve McQueen, 2019's take on the United California bank robbery, and why it didn't steal America's millions at the box office. Grab a shower cap and hop in the hot tub. It's The Bladder Presents, episode 137. Welcome back to The Bladder Presents, where we talk about how true crime is told and sold. Unfortunately, the sound drop that I was looking for from the last time my guest appeared on this fine podcast, fuck out of here with that, is 6 feet away from me and I can't locate it, but I hope that Mike Dunn will soldier on anyway. Hello again, Mike.
Hello, how art thou?
I art okay so far, and thee?
You know, just isolating in place like the rest of us. You know, I'm finding my inner Martha Mitchell, if you will.
Okay.
To relate to the second part of our podcast today, my inner Martha Mitchell is taking over.
Better that, I guess, than your inner Martha Stewart. It just depends on how you're going to spend your pandemic, I guess. Here's how I'm going to spend it with our most wanted section. We are talking about The Scheme, which airs, I believe as you're listening to this, it aired last night on HBO. Here's the case file from HBO's landing page. Quote, on September 26th, 2017, an extensive two-year undercover FBI investigation into a basketball corruption scandal led to the arrest of executives at Adidas and assistant coaches at major college programs. We'll get back to that part. At the center of it all was Christian Dawkins, an unassuming and unknown 25-year-old who was allegedly part of a criminal enterprise that infiltrated college basketball teams and funneled hundreds of thousands of dollars to steer recruits to prominent athletic programs. For the first time ever, Dawkins explains how a kid from Saginaw, Michigan wound up in a hotel suite surrounded by FBI agents with a warrant for his arrest. End quote. If you've ever listened to anything I've ever done on these here podcast airwaves, you know that I am a pay the players crackpot. So this documentary was basically made for me, but I'm not actually sure how good it is for A, people who are not familiar with college hoops and college sports generally, or B, because I at least am desperate to see anything that has to do with the sports that I follow and maybe not as picky as I could be, but I found this a pretty enjoyable 2 hours. Overall, Mike, what did you think of this one?
I agree with you. I did find it very enjoyable, but like what you were just saying in regards to the paying of the athletes, to me, I felt like I came out of this documentary thinking to myself, there's like two or three other documentaries that can be made about this story that we've heard, even yes. little details about this actual case that I would love to see, more so than what happened to Christian Dawkins, which is worthy enough of a documentary, but there was other stories built into this that I was like dying to see. I mean, one, obviously just the overall bullshittiness of pay for play in general from the NCAA and how like to me, I think it was like in the last 15 minutes where they really kicked it off by talking about how much the colleges make just from the sneaker companies.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was just like, Jesus freaking, I didn't realize it was that much money. I mean, in a year they make some of the schools were getting $200 million from Nike or Adidas. I mean, that was freaking ridiculous. Yeah. So that, you know, I would love to see a documentary about that. I would love to see a documentary just overall about the whole gigantic issue that I want Ken Burns to do a 10-part documentary about just, you know, pay for play and the NCAA for all sports, not just basketball, but for football too.
I mean,
and then there's another one that we'll get to later as we dive into things that I really want to get into in regards to, I want this other documentary made, but I'll throw it back to you.
Well, it's funny because this documentary, like, if they just like kind of breeze by all the shit that went down at Louisville in like 90 seconds of screen time,
right,
that shows you how packed this documentary is. But
yes,
at the same time, there are other series like QB1, for example, like Last Chance U, that's more focused on and nibbling around the edges of D1 football programs and how that's working or not working in the lives of these athletes. So this could definitely be a series. And the director, I'm actually not sure how you pronounce his last name, but I'm going with Condellis, did a documentary on the Baylor, like the disgraced Baylor program called Disgraced, which I talked about on this podcast with Allison Lohuff.
He's got a niche, doesn't he?
Yeah. And it's a really good niche, but like,
oh, very good. Yes.
Turn my man loose on a Netflix series, please.
Absolutely. Let's get multiple episodes. I'd rather see 10 episodes of this than, you know, unfortunately I did sit through Tiger King, but you give me 10 episodes about the overall aspect of payments and the sneaker companies and agents and how it all ties into what goes on in the NCAA these days and why these kids aren't getting paid for what they're doing would be a fascinating watch. And I hope that that's what, like, maybe this was his, you know, dipping his toe in the water to, you know, for what he wants to do next, that he was getting his feet wet and that he's just going to expand on this, you know, a little bit more. So,
I mean, if he makes one like every 6 months and the next one is like KO and it's about Coach K, who you have to wonder why every time there's a drive by on some, you know, basketball perennial powerhouse,
right,
that it's like, oh, so you're keeping Duke's name out of your mouth, even though you're going to hang a lantern on Zion Williamson. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Anyway, this documentary is, Dawkins is extremely charismatic and a good storyteller. He is like the bulk of the talking head interviews. He has a certain way of putting things that like half the clips I have are just like him being hilarious. And he's like so smart. Like, he started this fucking hustle when he was like 11.
Yeah, crazy.
He started basically a subscription service blog for coaches only, and a subscription was $600
a year. $600, and he was like 13.
Yeah, he has like two pubes, and he's like, what? Here's the clip.
It was very detailed, almost in a frightening manner, on who the top middle school players were in the state of Michigan. People were signing up, and nobody knew who this guy was that was rating and ranking these players.
I think I charged coaches around $600, college coaches.
Division I basketball coaches were paying $600 for this website this 12-year-old made in his basement. You know? The funniest thing was he ranked himself.
I did rank myself. I mean, it was times I ranked myself one. That was bad.
And he actually had listed himself as 6'2" when he was like 14 or 15. He's like 5'10" now.
I probably shouldn't have done that.
But he's like, eh. I mean, he's sort of like, yeah, I shouldn't have done that. But then he's like, yeah, I did that. Like,
it's, yeah, and then like smirky smile. Mm-hmm.
It's just badass. But yeah. Then, you know, then you sort of are walked through his career as an agent, like working with an agency and this well-known agent. And then he sort of hangs out his own shingle. And he's going to be like a manager, but he's sort of funneling talent to the agencies. And in order to do this, he needs basically venture capital.
Mm-hmm.
Because to be a, you know, to get your cut as the manager or the agent, you have to pay the players and often support their families. Like, this is just how it's done. And I feel like kind of everybody knows that this is how it's done. And like, I have zero problem with it for the athletes. Like,
mm-hmm.
get it then. Good for you.
Right.
My issue is with the, first of all, the hypocrisy, and second of all, this like plantation system that it sets up, and that inevitably it's not just the athletes of color, but like, you know, when you look at like a D1 hoops matchup, like usually not as much now, but often,
right? Yeah,
that, you know, coach is an old white dude and all the assistant coaches are people of color. And in something like this, who gets ground up in the gears? It's not Roy Williams, like, bless his heart, but it's not Roy right. Williams. It's not Coach right. K. Like, this one time, it was Rick Pitino. He's working again, though, right?
He just got a job at Iona.
Yeah.
So I mean, not, you know, not a major Division I school, but he did find his way back into a job again. So he still walked away from this being pretty unscathed, I would say. You know, yeah. Like, oh, poor guy, he had to sit out a year or two because the scandal was 2017. Oh, poor baby with the $8 million a year that he was getting paid, you know? Yeah.
So, well, and then I think the team was like, they could still play. They're in the same conference as Carolina. Like, that we would still play them, but like, it basically didn't count. It was like playing the computer or something. Like, it was weird. Right.
And even anyway. Dawkins made the point. He was like, if this was Cleveland State or Western Michigan, these programs would be gone
yes.
right now. But it's not going. But the schools that have these with these popular white coaches, where the colleges depend on that sneaker money that's coming in all the time, you know, they're going to get they even mentioned the point. Can we talk about the whore scandal and how Louisville only got the slap on the wrist for that? So, yeah. I mean, like, I think that was his reference point. Like, if that had happened out of Cleveland State or a Western Michigan, there would be no more college basketball at either of those institutions.
Yeah, exactly.
He's probably right. He's probably right.
Yeah. Meanwhile, one of the players that they're like, and then there was a recruiting violation with this guy. And it was like blatantly mm-hmm. a Carolina player who went in the draft last year. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, like, we all know that happens. But the other thing that sometimes happens is that you have a gazillion star recruit who is suspended for violating team protocols. You're never told what that means. And the next thing you know, he's playing in Finland. No one, like, everybody signed an NDA. Someone mm-hmm. was paid to make this go away.
Yep.
Everybody knows that this is what's going on. And yet the NCAA is like unable to admit to its own economy.
Mm-hmm.
So then you end up having these things turned into felonies. But let's start with the first clip that you asked for, which is basically right. explaining the sneaker company's motivations for funding like high school and, you know, like travel teams, basically, in clip yep. 3.
If you're Nike and you're trying to launch a new shoe and you needed to get some level of visibility on it or some level of recognition for, what's the best way to get that shoe out or get that shoe some exposure in Saginaw, Michigan? You put it on the high school team, the high school players. How else would Saginaw, Michigan know about a new Nike shoe? If I'm outfitting Zion Williamson in South Carolina with all Adidas or all Nike, pretty sure kids in that area are gonna buy Nikes and Adidas because he's gonna be the most popular, most visible person in the community.
I mean, see also the McDonald's All-America team for the high school players. Like,
yeah. See, that this clip fascinated me, and this part of the documentary fascinated me just because I didn't realize how big the sneaker companies were, even in the high school level and at the elite high school player programs that were going on. That was basically my ignorance, and that was shocking to me. And yet, here's this kid who puts on this basketball tournament in memory of his brother who passed away playing basketball, who was going to be the next big thing. And he's the one who went out and got the sneaker companies to basically pay for the program.
Yeah.
I think he was his older brother. He was the older brother at this point. So I guess he was like 16 or 17.
Yeah.
And he knew then how much that the sneaker companies were into this, even at the high school level. And I got to admit, this is me being completely ignorant. That shocked me. I mean, not just that the fact that the sneaker companies were there at that level, but how much he knew about it too. And I was like, okay, this kid's brilliant. This kid is really, yeah, really smart. And I can't wait to see what he does next. And then we do see what he does next.
I mean, and then the story he apparently he got out of, I think he's still appealing various verdicts, but like Atlantic Records was like, okay, you'll make something happen. Here you go.
Right.
But
not like some like one-off record company. No. He went straight to the top, Atlantic Records. I mean, my God. I mean, just a very, very impressive. Well, I can't say kid anymore, but I'm watching this entire thing as a teenager, as a young 20, 21-year-old, and I can only think of him as a kid at this point. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it really is. And I have to admire the fact that the New York Times wrote him up like last year around, I guess, verdict time. And the headline was something like the only honest man in college sports.
Right.
Because he'll just put it out there and be like, look, everybody does this and everybody knows that it's going on.
Yeah.
But it, like, for whatever reason, like this FBI agent, still known only to everyone as Jeff D'Angelo, who apparently was taken off the case for misappropriating funds on a Vegas trip. If the FBI admitted to that, it must have been really bad.
You just said the name of the person that I want to see another documentary on.
Yeah.
Who is Jeff D'Angelo and Jill Tucker? I mean, well, I think Jill Tucker or Jill Bailey, excuse me. I think they finally didn't know who Jill Bailey was, but then this whole disappearance of Jeff D'Angelo into this entire, well, I think we should probably go back into the story about how he gets involved first, but his story to me was fascinating in regards to its absence of details that I wanted to hear and see more about him. And I would love to see a documentary about him. So if
basically this dude, like, here's the situation. Like, Dawkins basically was charged with a whole bunch of federal crimes, like wire fraud and restraint of trade and like a bunch of things that are usually like RICO predicates. And that's like how you're trying to get some, you know, crime lord on something else. But the agent pushes so hard for Dawkins to commit a felony, which, like, it's borderline whether it's a felony. This dude does not know how the business works,
right?
But Dawkins needs the walking around money to, like, you have to spend money to make money in this business. Basically, like, if you want a Zion Williamson or a Kobe White or a Nasir Little, apparently you need to show the family that you're going to take care of them, and then they sign with you, and then you get a percentage, and then everybody's taken care of. Like, that's, you know, whatever. That's how it works.
Yeah.
Or doesn't work. But everybody has to pretend that that's not going on. D'Angelo is trying to get him to like bribe the coaches to send him players, even though that's really not
right
how it works. I mean, we have a clip about that, so I'm just going to skip ahead to clip 5.
Yep, go for it.
He doesn't understand how the business works if he thinks that it makes sense to just go out here and pay coaches. I was never, ever, ever given a player directly from a coach. Ever. I never signed anyone. If anything, I got to fight the coaches to keep them from going to they want to keep them in school. They don't want the fucking players to leave and go to the NBA. So I'm fighting with them. They're not trying to push dudes to the NBA. That's a lie. The only person who does that is Kentucky, because they got 5 more coming.
Christian has the players locked in theory before they ever get to the school.
I mean, the fact of the matter is this, Jeff. The coaches have a level of influence, but it isn't the end all be all. I mean, fuck, I'm more powerful than any coach you're going to meet. No one knows you or your background or you know, who you are, what you may be. So these guys have worked their whole lives to get to this point. And if one thing goes wrong, especially, and not to make this thing a race thing or whatever the case may be, especially a guy that's a black assistant coach, if you got one fucking thing happen to you, you're never coach again. That's just the bottom line.
Well, I'm with you.
Well, and this is, you know, there needs to be, I think, another whole, not necessarily a whole other documentary, but I wouldn't have mind seeing that be unpacked a little more. The fact that, you know, like it's not the, what's his face in Arizona? Sean Miller?
I feel like Sean Miller, yes.
10 Sean Millers like coaching yes. in various sports, and I can't always keep them straight.
And then we had an Andy Miller, right? He was the agent at the top. So easy to confuse our Millers.
Yeah.
It's Miller time. I'm sorry.
But then the assistant coach like did a few months, I think, in jail. And like, you know.
The assistant coach, yes. Yeah. Not the head coach. The assistant coach, yes. Yeah. Was it Book Richardson.
And like Coach K is like, you know, this is someone who's like allegedly, whatever, physically abusive. Whatever happens with that, really nothing. Like whenever there's a recruiting violations problem, whatever athletic department circles the wagons and is like, who's the 31-year-old African-American that we can throw under the booster bus for right. being a rogue element because our brand relies on keeping Coach K, you know, Roy, Jim Boeheim, whoever else. And I'm like not, I mean, I'm always going to shade Coach K, but the other two, like, I'm not saying they did or didn't do anything, but like,
and also this LSU coach, whenever they showed any clip of him, I mean, you just saw the dishonesty dripping from him with everything that he said when he was in front of a microphone. But when they showed him coaching, you know, he was exactly like you would say about like Coach K. It's like this is the type of guy that probably like hits his kids in practice. There's this physical intensity about him from a coaching perspective that turned me off. And then watching him cower under a microphone, I was like, this guy is so freaking guilty. How? And again, this is the part of this documentary that, like I said, I wanted to see more of this because I want to see more about that guy and why was he not arrested and put in jail or they always get fined. And that scene, it seems, and that's it.
Yeah. I want to find like out. They, you know, feeder tournament championship is revoked or like they scratch right. your name off the trophy. Like, get, you know, give yeah. me a break, please.
Yeah. Even he even said that Dawkins even said that he was like, yeah, they took it away from him. They were still the fucking national champions.
Yeah.
I think that was exactly how he worded it too. He's like, really? Like people are going to forget that they won that game when, you know, 38% of the country was watching on CBS. No, they're not going to forget that. And they're not going to remember that the NCAA 3 years later took away their title. That's right. Not what's going to happen.
Well, so, and, you know, these coaches make however much money a year. The athletic department makes however much money a year. There's merchandising that these D1 schools make. I mean, there is really a lot of money to go around. But because nobody can admit to that, then you have these things turned into like felonies at the federal level where like because you agreed in one conversation on the phone, you pretended that you were going to bribe whoever. Who's the sweaty guy who coaches Tennessee? Bruce something?
Oh, God. I'm sorry. I can't help you.
Listen, I mean, if we have any listeners left by this time, like, this is basically Buncey's Hoops hour. But, like, look, it was a really shitty season for the Heels, and I have to go somewhere with this stuff. Okay.
I'll get my basketball people out there to make sure that they're in on this.
Oh,
I promise.
There
is a lot of them too. So
awesome. And
then, I mean, we're going through our own personal March Madness right now. This could help actually,
really
relieve them of their absence of hoops. So
I mean, again, this is a big part of why this was enjoyable. That I was like, oh,
yeah.
Someone just shat on Kentucky. Hey,
yeah.
Day made.
Yeah.
But I just wish, like, in this clip, they're explaining why this is so bogus. And then at the end of it, you have the head of the NCAA being like, basically invoking the spirit of the ancient Greek Olympiad or whatever
right.
the fuck. Like, who are you kidding? And also, how much do you get paid and by whom?
Right.
Clip four.
Yeah, and this title of amateurism.
Oh, my God. Well, yeah. By which they don't mean amateurishness, but maybe they should. Clip four.
Exactly.
The thing was, though, because of the way this business was going to have to operate, they needed untraceable cash. That's what you create with these rules. Instead of just it all being on the up and up, you have to hide it because of amateurism. The NCAA thinks you have to play for the love of the game and can't get paid to play sports. It's amateurism. Amateurism to college athletics is just their theory that allows them to not pay the student athletes other than a scholarship, room and board.
The issue of pay for play will not go away. There'll continue to be people that say these are professionals and they ought to be paid like professionals, and I couldn't disagree more. I think that would be the complete death of college athletics.
I mean, obviously, college athletics can't be killed. Like,
right.
Repeated attempts have been made, and it just won't happen. Like, here's the thing, also, is that a lot of these guys make you a lot of money. Like, Zion Williamson, however much money he was getting on the side or under the table or whatever kind of way,
right.
He made his local high school, and he made his travel team, he made the All-America team, mm-hmm. and Duke, and he's on the Pelicans, right?
Yes.
He probably made, like, even the doctor who did his surgery and whoever put him on, like, an all, you know, skinless turkey diet.
Yeah.
Everybody makes money. Zion right. is a money printing press. He is a mint.
Right. Yeah.
He went to Duke. Even I love him. Okay.
Right.
So
and I think, you know, one of the reasons I think Watkins was able to buy into this so quickly, because he even said, I quit playing basketball because we had Draymond Green on our team.
He's
now one of the best players in the NBA. But again, this was me being so impressed with him, like him saying, like, I'm watching Draymond Green play. And I was like, I can't even match up with that. I need to find something else. And I'm going to go read this book that's going to go change my
yes,
life.
Yes. I love that.
Blew me away. That blew me away about this kid.
Yeah.
Like, this kid is so smart.
It was like a business memoir about
yes.
like sneakers influence on sports. And I was like,
right.
damn. So,
yeah.
And I think they actually did make a 30 for 30 based loosely on that book and maybe another one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was called something. It was some other pun on soul, but.
Okay. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to try to grab that book and read it also so that I can make as much money from being awesome and clever as Dawkins did. But like a player like Zion, like, you know, Carolina gets the ones that don't go to Duke who get hurt a little more often. And it's like if this guy is being looked to by not just the school, but his whole family, including some people that he's never met before who are like, it's me, your cousin.
Right.
I need a car. Like, they should be paid and signed to contracts so that if they get hurt and it doesn't happen for them, they're protected.
Right. Because, and they can do 1 year, 2 years.
Sometimes they go to class to nap.
Right. And I would think it was the author, was named Dan Wetzel, who made the great point that Google can go into any high school right now and grab a kid to do coding for them.
Yes.
And bring them right into their company right away. And how is that any different from going to play basketball? Yeah. It's not. And, you know, I mean, I don't even know, like, I can't even think of anyone that I know, like, even like people that I watch on sports that even think that these kids shouldn't get paid.
No,
I don't know. I can't think of a single person except for the NCAA itself. I can't think of anyone else.
Bonkers too. Like, there was a kid in my RA group that was his entire education through, like, definitely undergrad. But as far as he was wanting to go with his education, Apple was going to pay for it because he wrote some line of code that fixed some damn thing on the Macintosh SE. I don't know what happened. The day we started our freshman year of college, he had been 16 years old for 10 days.
Right.
Okay. That was all fine, but my D1 school, which was like, whatever, it's hilarious that Princeton is a D1 school, but technically it is, they can't even give scholarships.
Right. Yeah, no Ivy League schools can still, right?
Yeah. So the strenuous workarounds and like the way that they would have to, like, even if they wanted to have a booster's banquet and buy the football team some steak, like the things that they had to call it, and like they would have to technically not be on the campus, or it would be considered pay for play for like some crappy steak that they got from the Department of Food Services that may have come from a horse. Like, guys, it boggles my mind, truly. Yeah. Like, just be real. But now, thanks to this probably compromised FBI agent who couldn't even, you have the right to face your accuser. Dawkins did not get to do that. I think that's part of the basis of his appeal. That this guy is pushing so hard, and it's like obvious in retrospect, Dawkins must be kicking himself, but it's like this guy is like setting up a Wile E. Coyote style bear trap for me. And shoving me into it, but because he refused to take a deal and he got convicted, now that kind of thing is a fraud because he was convicted of that fraud because a precedent has been set. So I'm going to skip ahead to clip 7, where this Yahoo Sports guy, who generally is a pretty good talking head, but at one point he's like, yeah, it's weird how the assistant coaches all got ground up in the gears and, you know, it stopped before it got to the head coaches. I don't know why. I'm like, really?
You know why?
Sports writer?
Come on. Yeah.
And newborn? You don't know why? Right. Anyway, dumb quote. They should have cut that, but here's clip 7.
A legal precedent has been set. In theory, they're saying if you cause an athlete to no longer be eligible for his scholarship, you've defrauded a school, which is a felony now, a federal felony. Now, that could be any booster that gives any money to an athlete. That could be the local pizza shop when the kid comes in and he's the star quarterback. You say, here's a free slice of pizza. You've now made these players ineligible. Have you just defrauded this massive university? I don't know.
If I was giving that same money to a professional player, it's totally fine. Or if I was giving that money to someone who was in high school, who just didn't go to college, who just was like, I'm not going to NCAA, I'm gonna go to the D League, it's totally fine. But just because someone wants to play basketball in college, it's a wire fraud. That doesn't even make common sense to me.
No, it doesn't.
It does not.
But here's the thing. The way the power structure is now, the people who get the money are afraid that if they bring it all out into the light, then they are going to be the roaches that have to scuttle into the corners. Like, you know, I really feel, again, like there is plenty of money for everyone, given that all you're doing Coach K is running up and down the sidelines in a suit, yelling at other people who are doing the work.
And the fact that these head coaches that are featured in this documentary, I mean, they had them on tape. So I don't understand. That was the part that I had some difficulty with as well. They had them on tape having conversations with Dawkins, talking about players. They're obviously talking about money. And yet they couldn't even get them to answer to their subpoenas. They kept saying that they were subpoenaed, but they didn't reply to the subpoena. So they never showed up they never appeared in court. Was Donald Trump running this?
Apparently, according to the Southern District of New York, the way that this case is formulated, the head coaches are the victims.
Right. Which is telling me that someone from the Southern District knows Mark Emmert from the NCAA pretty damn well. I'm sorry, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but that's the other thing. The Southern District came out of this smelling really, really badly. Yeah. As much as, you know, they've been admired and are, I guess, continue to be admired for the cases that they're pursuing right now. But in this case in general, especially when the guy stood up and said, "We have their playbook." Well, no, you didn't, because if you had their playbook, you would have followed up on someone else, and you didn't. The only victim still to this day, for the most part, that did any jail time was a 25-year-old kid who made you all look stupid.
Yeah. And who is going to run rings around you in another business where it isn't quite so hypocritical in terms of what it takes to get shit done. I mean, you know, in the, like, before coronavirus and after coronavirus, like, who knows what any industry looks like, but
right.
Anyone who can tell a story like this.
Yeah.
Clip 6. And listeners, see if you can spot the phrase that I'm going to be incorporating into my daily life, even though it is completely irrelevant.
Maybe like an hour go by, me just being quiet. And eventually he goes, "What are you here for?" So I told him, he's like, "Yeah, no, you were here for something else. They didn't fucking put you in here or arrest you for paying some basketball players." I'm like, "I swear, bro." I'm a curious person. So I started to have questions. And I was like, you know, "Who are some of the people that's around?" And then he was like, "El Chapo's upstairs." What? And I'm thinking, okay, how could I be in the same vicinity as El Chapo? This cannot be real life right now. No disrespect to El Chapo and what they got going on, but I got to get the fuck out of here.
I love that he's like, "Look, no disrespect to the, you know, El Chapo sphere, but I'm gonna bounce." Like,
Sarah, I've learned something just to this very, very second in regards to you having me on these podcasts, and it seems that 50% of the time someone has to say, "Get the fuck out of here."
In some amazing, you know what I got? You know what I say to that? Fuck out of here with that.
Fuck out of here with that.
Yeah, I'm going to find that clip, I swear to God. I just thought it was so funny that he's like, "Look, no disrespect to El Chapo and everything that they're doing."
Yeah.
We've really enjoyed that organization's commitment to innovating in the sphere of escaping. Like, I just thought that was so funny. So I've just started saying it to, like, the pets. It's like, "Look, no disrespect to El Chapo and what they've got going on, but you need to get out of my lap." Yeah. I mean,
and yet there's still so much more to this that we can talk about too, that we haven't even touched on, you know, like just in interesting characters. I mean, we haven't even said the name Marty Blazer and his foray into the film industry.
Oh,
I mean,
God. My Mafia. Goodness.
It's so, Ving Rhames. Why? Why, Ving? Come on.
Yeah. You had the meats. What's wrong with you? You didn't need to do this.
Actually, I think that was one of my favorite Christian Dawkins quotes through all of this. He was like, "Marty Blazer should go to jail for making that fucking movie."
Oh my God, seriously. I recommend the scheme. Like, I think that if you are desperate for anything to do with sports, this will get it done. You should hunt down Condellis's other documentary, Disgraced, on this same topic, which I believe aired on Showtime, but this one should be on HBO Go. Give it a look. I don't know, like if you don't, if you aren't familiar with college sports and all of this bullshit, and you like, I'm not sure it does the best job it possibly could unpacking, or sort of taking you through like the actual rules and then all the workarounds that various programs have and have been caught doing. But I still think it's enjoyable because of Dawkins being like, I'm not here to shit on El Chapo. I just want to go home. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So yeah, I'd recommend it. Okay. You?
As would I. Yeah, no, it's a really good watch. Again, I think there's a lot of stories that I would love to see expanded upon that to come out from this. Because again, there's some interesting characters that I would like to hear more about. And I would also like to see just a bigger, like you said, like a 10-part series, a 10-part episodic series about the entire question of pay for play in the NCAAs. And we'll see if it ever gets made. But this is a good first step towards hopefully something like that being made. I enjoyed it.
For sure. And when our chief complaint is that we wanted it to be longer, we wanted it to have more, that's not a bad thing. So,
right.
Yeah. That's The Scheme, directed by Pat Condellis, and it is on HBO. Despite the fact that that Fichtner with his shirt unbuttoned to his navel is heavily featured in our cold case, I'm not sure I can recommend this one, despite certain surface similarities to a movie you and I both love, Ocean's 11, and actual references to the original, which I didn't love so much. But anyway, we're talking about Finding Steve McQueen. Here's the case file from the IMDb. Quote, in 1972, a gang of close-knit thieves from Youngstown, Ohio, attempt to steal $30 million in illegal contributions and blackmail money from President Richard Nixon's secret fund. End quote. This is based on an actual case, which is known as the United California Bank Job. The thieves got away with $9 million, but then they pulled a similar job close to home a few months later and got busted as a result. There's also like a little side note about like they didn't run the dishwasher, so the FBI got prints off the dirty dishes and busted a lot of them.
Right, and someone leaving behind some baseball cards in the back of a taxi.
Oh yeah,
with some fingerprints on them as well.
I forgot about that.
Oh yeah.
I mean, look, that too. It's an hour and a half, which like I was like, oh, that it's like unusual for a narrative feature to still be that efficient. It's quite likable. You got, in addition to my man Fichty, you got Vikings Travis Fimmel. He's struggling a little accent-wise, but quite charming. You've got the lady who plays What's-Her-Name from Jessica Jones, who isn't Jessica Jones, Trish from Jessica Jones. Forrest Whitaker is in it. Lily Rabe is in it as his... Mm-hmm. Mentee, I guess.
Yeah.
Reese Coiro shows up for like the second time in 3 weeks on this podcast. He's got a fake mustache and he has a shower cap on in a lot of scenes. There's a what's his name from The Wire. It's a lot of people and they're all pretty good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I'm not totally sure what we're doing here. Like, there's a couple of very funny sight gags. Fimmel is amazing. Like, there's this one scene where he's playing with, he shows up at his new girlfriend's house, like, to meet the family. And he's like, hey, everyone. Oh. And it's literally everyone is wearing a sheriff's uniform except her mom.
Yeah. Oh, and you have to be a Pittsburgh Pirates fan.
Yes. And then he very frailly is like, go Pirates, which since I had a podcast by that name, I found. And also sometimes when Carolina's really bad, I root for Seton Hall. Go Pirates. So that was very charming. And then he's like running like a drum major and playing with kids. Like he has like this really weird energy in this role that I enjoyed a lot. Don't think it's that Steve McQueenie, but I enjoyed it. But the movie can't seem to decide if it's more about this semi-doomed romance between him and Trish from Jessica Jones, to whom he's been lying for like 5 years about his
I've
name.
I've got her name. It's Rachel Taylor.
Thank you.
Yes.
Or if it's about the heist and it's like, while it's making up its mind, it is really hammering us with pop culture references that are not necessary. The soundtrack must have cost a fortune. Like, it's perfectly pleasant to watch. Like, the soundtrack is good. These are, you know, legendary hits for a reason. I like looking at old cars, but like, what
can I say? This director, I have it even in my notes. Great soundtrack. This director seems to love Tommy James and the Shondells, and that just was like after my heart because I love Tommy James and the Shondells. He played 3 different Tommy James songs that made me really happy. So yeah, the soundtrack was for this was great.
Yeah, but it's also like, well, I don't know. Let me start with clip 8 where this is where Travis Fimmel has been busted by Rachel Taylor, and just the way he says look it up, it's just really funny to me.
And you changed your name because of a bunch of speeding tickets?
I changed my name because
why?
Because the FBI is looking for me. 8 years ago I robbed a bank in California.
Bullshit.
That's the biggest bank heist in U.S. history. Look it up.
Look it up. This is right after he has ordered every dessert on this diner menu. And then in another scene, he's like getting powdered sugar in a bomb, basically. I kind of wanted to believe that that was a nod to Rusty Ryan always snacking in Ocean's 11. Did you feel like that might have been a thing?
Well, there was definitely an Ocean's 11 feel to this entire movie. And actually, I did listen to a couple episodes of a podcast about this case as well. And even the narrator makes mentions to Ocean's 11 in it. I mean, there was one scene where they even said they mentioned it was like, oh, it was like Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. driving away in that film. It's like, what film? Oh, Ocean's 11. And I got it right written right here in my notes. Oh, the shitty version.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Everyone realizes that that's not the good version, that the George Clooney version blows it away. That it was not really a good movie. But
I thought the soundtrack might have been by the same guy. I looked it up. It is not. The soundtrack, it does have that very jazzy, like David Holmes gritty shaker sound. Mm-hmm. It, but it's by a guy named Victor Reyes. Like, if that's what he was going for, an homage to the, you know, the good version versus the Sinatra version, I'm into it. But
yeah,
like making the comparison explicit, like making it text instead of subtext is not great. Here's Forrest Whitaker and Lily Rabe looking down the giant hole that the robbers used to get into this bank. This is one of those scenes that is like everything that's both good and annoying about finding Steve McQueen, because there's like a little bit of like processy, like this is an FBI agent explaining why California it leads the nation in bank robberies. Mm-hmm. But then there's this like goofy pop culture reference that you're like, oh my God, we get it. Anyway, clip 10.
I'm not sure I follow, sir.
We're the bank robbery capital of the world for 2 reasons. On-ramps and off-ramps. I mean, the last time I saw a ball job like this, Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin were doing it. In that movie. Ocean's 11.
I never saw it, sir.
You gotta get out more, sure.
Yes, sir.
I mean, what a waste of Lily Rabe, although she can really wear these period costumes. She looks fantastic. She has one of those dresses that has the tie with the brooch pin. Oh my God, it just looks so cool. Yes. The movie looks great. There's a fight that they're having with, like, they're in the hot tub in this mansion that they rented because they can see the bank from there. Some guy shanks a drive into the hot tub, and there's this, like, no, fuck. You fight that I clipped it, but like, who cares? It's funny.
It would be better if it was video clipped so we can see that shower cap another time.
Yeah,
so
which like keeps showing up. Like he's in the actual shower with it, and then
yeah,
there's he's in the hot tub with Herc, not yeah, Herc from The Wire and Darren from Animal Kingdom.
Yep.
Who is quite a good actor, Jake Weary, and he gets like a line.
A line almost in the entire movie. I felt like he spoke like three times and that was it. I didn't even like know how much of a character he was going to be in this film. And turns out
that was another thing that it was like, I felt like they were trying to say something about between Fichtner's repeated rants about Nixon and the sort of war criminess of the war in Vietnam. And, the brother being this sort of touched by trauma person who, like, he seemed at peace, but he just never spoke.
Yep.
That it's like, do you want this to be a real element of this story or don't you? Otherwise, it's like you're playing this as a joke, which I guess is fine. But in an hour and a half, like, why is this also happening?
Yeah. I mean, it felt like to me like the only important parts of the film for him was him and his connection with these baseball cards. Watching him, I mean, hearing him go, got it, got it, got it, and seeing him grow this attachment to a couple of these cards. I mean, the first scene in the movie was the picture of the Harmon Killebrew baseball card.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, so this is going to be a part of the story. I didn't realize how much of a part of the story it was going to be. We find out eventually that it was all because Charles Coulson from Watergate fame, obviously. Was a baseball card collector, and he kept his baseball cards in a safety deposit box. So, like, but I kept wondering. I was like, "Are we going to include the brother more in this film?" And like, to me, the scenes that stood out were two scenes that involved baseball cards for the most part, and that was it. And I was like, "We needed to do a little bit more with his character."
Well, and don't go that way with it. But
right.
I mean, they had these moments where it would be almost processy in the best ways about Ocean's 11, where like it's not just that like it's funny and they're grumpy with each other and like get in the goddamn house, like, you know, denim like the jean, like whatever, we could do this all night and might after and you, we turn the mics off.
But we've done that a lot.
We certainly have, like, take it to Twitter, wait, don't. But there's also that it's like underlaid with this, not like bedrock knowledge, but like there's a foundation of understanding how physically, logistically, mechanically the heist is going to work. And there are enough moments of that in this movie that I'm like, I feel like he carefully measured out each part. Like, here's the processy heisty part, and here's the familial part, and here's the like rom-com part, and he made sure they were all equal. And that was like, it made it less than the sum of the parts. Here's Travis Fimmel having stolen an alarm in clip 9, and this is exactly what I'm talking about. Like, you get a lot of interesting information about how this would be accomplished. And then there's this goofy line about the GTO, like, oh my God, we fucking know it's a GTO. Anyway, here's the clip.
Hey, you even know what low profile means?
What?
I said get photos.
Huh? Photos.
Photos wouldn't have told us that the alarm ran on batteries. Now we know that cutting the electricity. What a ton of
shit. Come here.
You got balls. Torch the car.
What? This is a Pontiac GTO. This is going to be a classy car someday.
That's great. Always torch the car after a job.
I just stole it last week.
Really? Lesson fucking learned.
And then right after that, it's like, like the horns on the soundtrack. Like, I mean, this movie, like, I'm not angry that I spent 90 minutes with it, even though it cost me $3. And that's the other thing. Like, I feel like this movie was really being advertised a lot, and then it fell down a manhole. And it's not bad. It just should be like four times better than it is.
I've recast this movie in my mind, and this movie also reminds me of another movie, and I feel terrible because I can't remember the name of the movie, but there's a likeness in regards to the fact that this is a fascinating story.
Right.
And it reminds me of, there was a movie made about when the country musician from the early 70s, Gram Parsons, died, and they stole his body so they can burn it in the Joshua Tree National Park.
They made
a movie about it. I was like, that's an amazing story that has to be told and has to be written and about, and there's got to be a movie made. And it was a mediocre film. And that's how I felt about watching this. I was like, this is a great, great story. And I've already recast like the lead with Chris Pine. I've already recast the girlfriend. I've already recast the girlfriend with Margot Robbie.
Uh-huh.
You know, I've already put what's his name? Jeremy Renner as one of the fellows. Say,
yes.
As one of the fellow burglars.
Okay.
Okay. Not all. Okay. Maybe not the entire film, but you get the idea that this movie, there should have been a really, really good script of this that went around Hollywood that all the people that I just mentioned would have read and said, yeah, I want to do that movie. So,
okay.
Again,
I'm just going to break in. Was it called Grand Theft Parsons?
There you go.
I mean,
I think the story, but not the movie. I don't think the movie was called Grand Theft Parsons.
It's a 2003 comedy drama starring Johnny Knoxville.
Oh, that is it. Yes.
Michael Shannon, Christina Applegate. Like, here's where you lose me is Johnny Knoxville. Sorry, Tara. But yeah, I mean, I am going to listen to that podcast. It's been on my list for a while. And I think if you actually want, as I do, like nuts and bolts of a bank job, like Norco 80 is like violent and sad, but is very good logistically at letting you understand, especially with the getaway chase, which is the bulk of the story, kind of where everybody is and what had to happen and what's happening sort of in parallel, on parallel roads and stuff like that. And I bet that this podcast is better at that heisty part of it.
Yeah. And actually the host of the podcast was the person who submitted the first script for this film. And at one point in the podcast, he even says, he's setting up this story. And he's like, oh my God, this has everything. And this is the story. And this was right before the film was about to come out. He's like, it's the story of this is a story that should be a Hollywood smash. And then it didn't become one.
Well, and it really should be. Like, you have, I mean, here's the thing. You're so right that it needs one of the Chrises.
Mm-hmm.
I don't actually care which one. Well, right. Pratt has gotten a little weird.
I was going with Pine because of the Steve McQueen, you know, references. Even though I don't think this guy in real life looked like Steve McQueen, but since that was one of the overall themes of the film, this guy's obsession with Steve McQueen and you know, driving fast and everything, I can see a Chris Pine to Steve McQueen similarity. So that's why I was thinking of him.
I think Chris Pine is perfect for this, and I think as his brother, the other guy from Into the Woods, who they had a duet together, Billy Magnuson. They both played princes. They were on screen for like 2 minutes, but it was like, please spin this off into a series of 17 movies. I will go to see all of them. Billy Magnuson is amazing. I love him. Or fuck it. Do 33 short films about the United California bank job and just recast it like, I don't know, like all kids, all cats. Mm-hmm. I don't care. It should be better. It's frustrating. That said, if you're in the room and it's on, you don't have to like run out of the room, but it's kind of a big ask for you to pay for it. So wait for it to come to like, I don't know, Showtime 5.
And if you've ever said to yourself, the thing that I need to see in a movie is Forrest Whitaker playing the French horn, this is the movie for you.
It is.
But beyond that, like I said, I wanted a better movie out of this. And I think there is a better movie to be made. And I hope that one day it does get made. So I would,
I mean, if we were, that was such a cute character detail. And then it's like that Lily Rabe comes in. She's like, he's getting better. Right. And his secretary pops an earplug out and is like, what? Listeners, if you've watched this, Let us hear from you at Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram. And also, if you've listened to the companion podcast, which is called Stealing Nixon's Millions, and it's not really a companion podcast, but, you know, same story, came out at the same time. Let us know what you thought of that. Sorry, Mike, you were saying?
No, it's just basically just my overall review is just going to, you know, like I'm sticking out my hand and it's like one of those, like someone judge on it, thumbs up or thumbs down. And my thumb is just not moving. It's just middling right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's fine. It's not an insulting movie. It's not a great movie either. It's watchable.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. Yeah. One other thing for people like me and you, Watergate completists.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure. And, you know, yeah. Fichtner enthusiasts. He looks great. What can I say?
Yeah.
In local news today, bees.
If you would like to plug your or someone else's shtees, now's the time.
So you can find me on Twitter at MikeyWMFree. So you can see some of my musings there about anything and else, anything and everything that's going on, mostly about music or film or whatever's going on in the news. And in the very near future, now that I'm isolated in place, although I still have a job, thankfully, but now that I have extra time to be spending at home, look for me to finally start my music blog, which used to be called Shows of Note back in the day. A new name still to be determined. I welcome your suggestions.
I am very excited to hear this. I'm a little sad that obviously the shows will be like, you know, tiny desk concerts, Liz Phair in her old bedroom, but they're still of note. I'm very excited to hear that you're going to restart that. Outstanding.
Actually, maybe that'll be my first story, the live streams of note, because there are a lot of really, really good ones that are going on right now. So maybe something like that is what I'll start with.
It's been nice to spend time with you at a government mandated distance.
Yay.
Coming up on The Blotter Presents, it's Toby Ball on the Atlanta Child Murders series on HBO, and I've got a couple of author interviews in the can. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, as I said, and, as I also said, on the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. Paid subscriptions really help. But for the next little while, it is free to all subscribers, and we are taking pitches. So if you've got a book you absolutely have to review, sign up today and email me. My guest has been Michael Dunn. He's on Twitter once again at MikeyWMFree. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time. Really? When hopefully I will know how to run the soundboard. Oh! I blame Jeff D'Angelo for that. What's he gonna do about it?
He doesn't exist anyway.
It's true.
You know what I say about that? Fuck out of here with that.